Thanks, 10-4.
You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. You're tuned to This Week in Radio News. I'm Tom Rowe in the Wave Farm Study Center in upstate New York. Brian Clark and Mark Gunziger from the Center for Strategic Budgetary Assessments released their paper, Winning the Airwaves, Sustaining America's Advantage in the Electronic Spectrum, on December 1st, warning that America's military frontier will move from radio-controlled drones to jamming radio signals. The paper says the U.S. and Russia are both concerned with blocking radio signals now, with future drones used to launch jamming or hacking attacks. As enemies get their own radio-controlled devices, the U.S. will need to use radio technologies to disable those enemy drones. Quote, the U.S. military could shift toward using unmanned vehicles or expendable payloads that emit low-power jamming noise in the radio frequency spectrum, or dazzling electro-optical infrared sensors, or narrowly focused radar beams to establish accurate targeting information for attacks, unquote, the authors write. Drones will also be used as decoys to draw enemy fire and discover enemy positions, and cruise missiles will launch hacks and bomb radio signals with static. Light detection and ranging lasers, or LIDAR, will become a more sophisticated version of radar, detecting where radio signals come from. So television and radio transmitters will become targets in Clark's and Gunziger's predicted future. The media is full of predictions this fall that radio-controlled drones would be one of the most popular gifts this holiday season. Congress got prepared, too, giving the Federal Aviation Administration a September 30th deadline to develop and implement a plan for, quote, the safe integration of civil unmanned aircraft systems into the national airspace system, unquote. Until recently, the FAA had few rules designed just for toy model airplanes, and the Federal Communications Commission also lacks regulations for the radio-controlled vehicles. The FAA also realized it really has no way to register all drones, as they already have not been able to deal with the more than 2,000 requests for registrations they've gotten. Of course, the FAA missed that congressional deadline of September 30th, but it just issued a, quote, clarification, unquote, on registration and recommendations for drones from a 27-member task force filled with representatives, companies making and selling radio-controlled drones, and the aviation industry. The panel recommended that all drones get registered by logging into a website asking for limited information without a filing fee. The registrant would get an ID number to put on their aircraft. Non-registrants would pay fines under the proposal, and there would be a sliding charge of up to $25,000 for intentional violators, like recent attempts to smuggle contraband into prisons via drones. The Electronic Privacy Information Center says the proposal does not go far enough, as they want to require drone operators to register contact information and also surveillance capabilities that the drone may have. The group also proposes that drones should also broadcast their registration numbers.
We're finally in the future. There's a new bird in the sky, watching from heaven with an electronic eye. I finally got the feeling that there's nothing I can't do.
Like flying, that's why I feel so free to be watching you when you
That was DJ Earworm with Drone on This Week in Radio News. AlBawaba.com reports that Israel has shut down 3 radio stations this month in the occupied West Bank city of Hebron. Israeli military forces stormed the Dream radio station studios November 28th, destroying equipment and damaging offices. Israeli forces told station officials that Dream radio would be off for 6 months due to, quote, incitement against Israel, unquote. Al-Kahil Radio, or Hebron Radio, and the Manbar el-Hara Freedom Tribune station were also closed on grounds of incitement earlier in the month. The Jerusalem Post also reports that Israel's airwave war is also online, as the foreign ministry is creating software that discovers the words knife and Jew on social media. It may be able to find other words, too. A long time ago, now more than a decade, the Prometheus Radio Project, a pirate radio turned lobbyist and advocacy group promoting public access to the airwaves, challenged the Federal Communication Commission's media ownership rules, especially about television station joint sales agreements. The case has been shuffled from one jurisdiction to another over the years, but on December 3rd, oral arguments were scheduled in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Now Prometheus attorney Andrew Schwartzman tells Radio World that actually the Third Circuit will hear the case. After all the years of trading places in court, Prometheus wants the FCC to comply with the Third Circuit Court of Appeals order to justify or modify the government's method of increasing minority ownership, or propose new measures to do so. Instead, so far, the FCC has deferred a decision on the minority issues. Read more about that story in Radio World. British Broadcasting Corporation reports about a new method of delivering data using the visible spectrum rather than the invisible radio waves. The British Broadcasting Company reports about a new method of delivering data that's been successfully tested using visible spectrum rather than invisible radio waves. So-called Li-Fi can deliver internet access 100 times faster than current Wi-Fi with up to 1 gigabyte per second. A standard LED bulb, an internet connection, and a photo detector are used by the Estonian startup company Velmini. The company's laboratory tests have proven theoretical speeds of 224 gigabytes per second. The company's chief executive Deepak Solanki predicts consumers will be using Li-Fi within 3 to 4 years. Professor Harold Haas from Edinburgh University first demonstrated the technology at a TED conference in 2011, showing how it does not interfere with other radio signals and uses a part of the radio spectrum, the visible waves, that's 10,000 times larger than where radio waves currently travel. Sunlight is Li-Fi's kryptonite, though, and it does not travel through walls either. So this is an end-of-the-line technology for large office buildings mainly.
Final warning. Primary power offline in 10 seconds.
That's your warning for this week's Raw 911 recordings. Let's listen to a bit of the 911 phone calls from mass shootings in Colorado Springs at a Planned Parenthood attack and in San Bernardino at the holiday party. Warning, these recordings make for uncomfortable listening.
The second caller now, they're advising in the parking lot. Somebody is shooting. Actually, we're getting several more calls now.
Just call you that CSPD is working an active shooter. Again, CSPD has an active shooter. 3480 Centennial Boulevard at the Planned Parenthood.
Oh, they just brought a woman out.
Hey.
All units, one car has been shot.
Get a transport, Troy. Troy, need transport.
Car is taken off your
right.
At least one victim in the parking lot of a Leap Vision along with the King
Street.
One in the parking lot of Planned Parenthood and possibly a couple of additional others.
I was the subject is still inside the business, 1365 South Waterman. It's in building number 3, possible active shooter. One suspect.
6-4 being rounded.
Happy. One suspect so far, male in black clothing. He's still firing rounds. So we're 2 more units down to the south side. The shooter's supposed to be in a parking lot. No better description on that location with a machine gun for this RP.
Now we have 2 suspects, both dressed in black, and inside the business on the south side is what we're being told. Lincoln 3, we're being advised that one suspect fled in a black SUV westbound from the location. We do not know if we still have an active shooter. We supposedly have 2 down inside. We'll be making entry.
We have several down in the conference room. Several down. Stay several medically.
Next on This Week in Radio News, we recently spoke with Amanda Dawn Christie about her film Spectres of Shortwave that's almost finished, about an array of antennas from Radio Canada International that caused parts of a local community to hear radio waves in their kitchen appliances. Let's listen to Amanda Dawn Christie and her story of Spectres of Shortwave. And I'm Tom Rowe, and Amanda Dawn Christie is here. You're screening it's not finished yet. It's a work in progress, I guess?
That's correct. I'm going to show a work in progress.
And it's called, tell us what it's called and what it's all about.
Spectres of Shortwave is the English title, and the French title is Ombre des ondes courtes. And it's about a shortwave radio site that was recently dismantled in Canada. And the film, it's a feature-length experimental documentary, and it's about the Radio Canada International site. And that site was, it was near where I grew up, so a lot of locals, and myself included, just saw it as this amazing, interesting part of the landscape. It was 13 radio towers, 400 feet tall, all connected with antennas, and it's in this, situated in this marsh that's below sea level, so anytime you're driving home at night, what you see is all those red lights. And a lot of locals don't necessarily know what this, or didn't know what the site was for. And I started the project mostly documenting the images and the fact that people would hear the radio in their household appliances sometimes, sinks, fridges, toasters. And that fascinated me. And the more research I did, then I found out that was when I got interested in radio and shortwave radio. And as I started the film, our government made some pretty major budget cuts and they decided to tear it down. So my project drew out for an extra few years to include the demolition of the site, which I think it was quite tragic.
Did what, they sell it for scrap metal or?
Yeah. And I was told unofficially that, I mean, there was a station in Singapore that actually offered to buy it and they basically said no. It was worth more to them as scrap metal. And when I was documenting the demolition, I wasn't allowed to post any photos on Facebook or Twitter because they were afraid people would come and steal metal. There was, I think they said, 60,000 pounds of copper from just the wires, let alone all the steel. So it wasn't...
And copper was going through a big price hike internationally at the time, I believe.
Yeah, that was 2014. They got quite a lot of money for that. And, so they... And officially, like even CBC and the Radio Canada, there wasn't a lot of documentation. I think one night they did a little thing on the evening news in English. And over the course of 4 months, twice on the French CBC. And no one else was documenting it. So I think it's still a work in progress phase because editing the film right after it came down was a bit emotional for me. There was a lot of weight feeling like the only person who who is there on site documenting as a kind of a witness to the loss of this very important piece of communication technology. It was the largest site of its kind in Canada, and it was built during World War II, and it was the first Allied site to break through the jamming signals of the Iron Curtain, and contracted by Radio China, Korea, Vietnam. Quite a few other countries used this relay transmission site, and it was transmitting to the Arctic in the north of Canada, so as a source of news for people in very remote communities up north, it was very important. And then there was this idea that, well, everyone's got the internet, so who needs shortwave, which I think is very short-sighted.
You said there's not much, you were the only documenter of the destruction. Is there a lot of documentation of the toasters receiving radio signals?
As far as I've come across, no one has done audio recordings of them, and I don't have audio recordings of them because that phenomenon apparently became less and less frequent after the 1970s. They put a lot of filters, they found
ways. And that's, of course, when the small cassette recorders became available in the 1970s.
Yeah. And so they did stuff with filters and helped people to prevent that from happening. There was an older woman in the community who apparently heard radio in her sink for 2 hours every Sunday evening, but she didn't want me coming into her house. She was like the mother-in-law of a friend of a friend. And so I built my own radio sync. I took the schematic of a foxhole radio, or a crystal radio, rather, and built it using copper plumbing. So I'd go to the plumbing store after every paycheck and buy another 12 feet of copper, and I would take it out on the marsh to try and hear the radio, trying to build a functioning radio without any electronics. In the end, it didn't work because I didn't have enough pipe. Like, I would have needed, I think... to catch the shortwave, I would have needed about 40 meters of pipe, and I had, 24 feet, because copper was expensive. So I'm still working on that project as well. So mostly what I've recorded is interviews with people who experienced hearing the radio from their fridge and their toaster and their sink, and most of it was in their childhood or teenage years. I didn't meet many people who still experienced that in 2010 to 2012.
And kind of it seems like what I'm hearing is your kind of theory of why that would happen is the same as why you would twist metal wires into to be able to receive signals in a foxhole radio is basically a term for during the war people made radios with whatever materials they had to receive signals, and so. And this seems to go with along with the theremin too, is the twisting metal in certain ways, which is what the towers were doing on a large scale, a large more organized scale, I guess, or maybe not, if it was causing sinks to become radius. But so is that what it's sort of a metaphor for the towers themselves, what you're doing?
With the theremin or the...
With the theremin, yeah.
Well, the theremin is kind of more of, because I'd been working on the project for about 5 years or more, and I became very emotionally attached to the towers. So the theremin became, that project's, it's a metaphor, but the project's called Requiem for Radio. And it's, the idea is to play the ghosts of the radio towers with radio waves. So what I'll be doing with the theremins is, there were 13 radio towers, I want to build 13 theremins, one for each tower, to set up a scale model of the site. And the height of the theremin antennas will be relative to the height of the radio towers. And instead of hearing theremin sounds, it was interesting that you mentioned the contact mic recordings, because I had, when the towers were still standing, I put contact microphones on each of the radio towers to record their vibrations in the wind. At that point, they weren't transmitting anymore, but the marsh had very high winds. And so I've got these beautiful droning sounds that are almost like a voice for each tower. And so when I set up the scale model with the theremins, I'm writing a Maximus P patch so that the theremin becomes more of a trigger. So when you approach, say, theremin number 3, it'll trigger the sound of tower number 3. So it's this idea of conjuring the ghosts of the radio towers, even though it's all scientific and electromagnetic. It's this play of kind of requiem and remembering the past of that site.
All right, we're speaking with Amanda Dawn Christie about Spectres of Shortwave. Do you want to tell people anything about the film?
Sure. It started off as a landscape film, so it's not your traditional documentary. There's no talking heads. You're not going to see any people, but you'll hear people, like listening to the radio. And the imagery is, I filmed the site over four seasons, so spring, summer, fall, winter. And so it's various shots of the site, long, slow, meditative, a lot of driving shots. I filmed on 35mm film and scanned to digital. And then in the winter is the demolition. So the last 20 or 30 minutes of the film is just watching the site being dismantled. And the soundtrack, you'll hear stories from local residents in English and French, and because there's two languages in the region. And the film is, I chose not to subtitle it because radio is not subtitled. And one of the things I found interesting about international radio is that there are so many languages and you don't always understand them. So to me, if you don't understand one of the languages, I'm treating it like it's music. And it's just, imagine you're tuning into international radio. And the background sounds, there's these drones. And those drones in the background were all recorded when I placed contact microphones on the radio towers. And then the very final 20, 30 minutes. So you'll hear people talking in the first two-thirds of the film. Locals talking about the significance in the landscape. There's a section of people talking about hearing the radio in their household appliances. And there's sections of the technicians explaining how the site worked and what it did. And then as we watch the demolition, there's no voices. At that point, we're just watching. And my approach to making a documentary is I want the viewer to be more in the seat of a witness than a student. I didn't want to be an authority telling you how it is and what it is. I wanted it to be as if you stumbled across it the way I did. And that's why I've intercut stories by locals. So you're going to overhear the same stories that I heard when I was living there. And when the camera is going through the facility, because I also went inside the facility, going through the hallways and the transmitters and everything, I'm not necessarily going to explain what they are. It's going to be as if you've arrived there and you're exploring it on your own and overhearing local stories. And when the demolition happens, I want you to feel like you're there too, watching it like I did.
Nights, do I delay? Looking phone, no one's answering. Well, can't you just let it ring a little longer, longer, longer? Oh, I'll just sit tight through shadows of the night. Let it ring forevermore. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do-wah, do-be-do-do-wah, do-wah-do-lang. Blue days, black nights, do-wah-do-lang.
I look into the sky.
The love you need ain't gonna see it through.
And I wonder why
the little things you find ain't coming true.
That was the Electric Light Orchestra with Telephone Line, ending this week in radio news. Earlier we heard from Amanda Dawn Christie a little bit about her film Spectres of Shortwave. We heard some of the 911 recordings from recent mass shootings in the United States. We heard DJ Earworm's new song Drone about radio-controlled drones. And we heard all the headlines in radio news this week from around the radio dial.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.